Congratulations. You finally found the perfect podcast based on your hobbies and interests. There are many shows out there that cover the topics of fly tying and fly fishing, but none of them are as dumb as this one. It's astounding how stupid it is. Why bother to listen to someone talk about tying flies anyway? What are they going to tell you how many whip finishes they did today? Or maybe give you the exact ratio of materials and fibers in their custom dubbing recipe? Ha 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 ha. Do you believe in interdimensional beings? Me neither, I guess. This is Secret Society of Fly Tiers.
Hi. Thanks for tuning in. It is time for another episode of Secret Society of Fly Tiers. I am the permanent host of this program. I barely introduce myself, and when I do, I use different names and mumble my way through interviews. You can call me by any name that starts with the letter M. Let's go with Marvin today. I don't think I've used that one yet.
What about Mufaletta?
Okay, maybe not that. Or wait, that's a delicious sandwich, so yeah, why not? My name is Mufaletta, and this is Secret Society of Fly Tiers, the podcast.
Welcome to your doom.
You'll be glad to hear that I completed my homework again. I drafted another little report on a fly tying related topic that this here podcast pointed me towards. Picture me wandering aimlessly through content land, holding my magic dowsing rods, hunting for precious water and minerals, but instead finding cool people to teach me about interesting things and places. For episode 21, the podcast Juju directed me to Jeremiah Houle and commanded me to write about the Deschutes River near Bend, Oregon. Jeremiah was a guide for several years on the Deschutes and has since retired from his life behind the oars. He's now a sales rep for Loon and Riversmith and Aquaflies and Orvis and Scientific Anglers and more. You might know him as Jeremiah Superspay on Instagram. That's where I found him. I've been following him for a few years now and watching with envy at his exploits. That's all social media is really for, seeing the cool stuff other people are doing while you're not doing it. And for jokes. Jeremiah felt like the perfect fit to be this episode's chosen spokesperson to teach me and you about a river that's intrigued me for a long time now. Yeah, it's another show about a steelhead river in Oregon.
Big whoop, wanna fight about it?
Yeah, do you wanna fucking fight about it? Have you ever fought a skeleton with a back and neck that always hurts? What we lack in muscle and flexibility, we make up for with cheap, dishonorable, and underhanded moves like maybe an eye poke or an ear bite.
Look out, man.
My favorite is actually a move called the shark bite, where you grab someone by surprise from behind by the meat right above their hip, like your hand is a shark's mouth going in for a quick taste.
Hey, look out, man.
Matty baby, I don't want to fight you. I just want to love you forever. Please let go of your anger and give your love to me.
Yeah, I don't want to fight either. We're friends, and we all like fly fishing in nature's cathedral with stupid little bugs we tie up with all our crafting supplies. The steelhead often creep into that picture because they're cool, man. Jeremiah is cool. He's got years of experience on this river. And the Deschutes is cool, too. You can surf there. It's unique. You're gonna like this show, I promise. I also promise that someday I'll pay the president of the Werewolf Society, Peter Kane, to be a regular on my show.
I'm Peter Kane. I'm president of the Cryptid Society.
Hi, Peter Kane, president of the Dragon Foundation.
Hi, I'm Peter Kane, president of the Bigfoot community.
Well, I know what that is. That's a dog man.
I'm Peter Kane. I'm president of the Gremlin Society.
I'd have him deliver cryptid news like some kind of weird guest weatherman. That would be so cool, but it will never happen. He's already politely declined to record a promo for me, and I respect my cryptid hunting elders.
I'm not a gremlin. I'm clearly not a gremlin.
Big things cost money. I had a grand idea once to put together a TikTok-linked late-night talk show with my brilliant daughter as the host. My ideas for it turned out to be too big, though. My ideas can be like that sometimes, which is why I settled on a podcast. Podcasts are very quick and extremely easy to make, but they still cost money. I get an invoice every time you hear the worm's voice on my show.
Hey everybody, thanks. That will be $350.
And those add up because he's on almost every episode. I've been trying to convince him to accept autopay and give me some type of loyalty discount on his services, but he loves credit card processing fees. He craves them. Anyways, I was whining to my sister about how much money and how much effort I put into this podcast, and she told me that podcasting expenses were nowhere near the expenses of a cowboy, or a cowgirl, or a cowperson. My sister is a cowperson, you see? She went on and on about hay prices and the cost of rope cans and taking horses to the horse massage parlor.
Oh, baby.
And I tried to tell her that podcasting is just as expensive, maybe even more expensive than running a ranch. Plus, there were ways for my sister to offset these costs. For a second, I thought about jumping right to sending her the famous Mr. Hands video. The video that put Seattle's horse community on the map. But I knew that would make her think that this was all a joke. And don't expect a link to that video in the show notes either, you little creeps. She's my sister, and I actually wanted to help her. The first thing I told her was to start with feeding the garbage they throw out to the horses instead of hay. She has a family of four, and they produce lots of garbage. Horses love to eat garbage. They're just large goats, and horse scientists hate to admit that they're actually genetically related. This is a win-win. No more hay to buy, and no more garbage to haul to the dump.
How about you, you bitch? You make that deal?
I make that deal.
I don't blame you.
It is a great deal, and it's a double up of savings. I also had to remind her that she's wasting gallons upon gallons of horse milk every day. All she has to do is get on a milking schedule, bottle it or bag it, and pasteurize it. I think it's going to be the milk of the future, and will pair well with the bugs we'll all be eating soon because real meat will be illegal any day now.
Milk was a bad choice!
Which brings me to the last resource my cow sister is just wasting. Pounds and pounds of horse meat.
For the past month, Burger King in the UK and Ireland have been denying the claims that there is horse meat in their food products, when Burger King admitted that it was all true.
You better get it before it's outlawed like the rest of the meat we're used to. Or I guess it's already illegal here in California, and this podcast is definitely not selling horse meat, but there's a cow person I know who should be, I'll tell you that.
This is how to eat raw horse meat, or horse sashimi.
In all honesty, it really did sound expensive to be someone who owns horses, but my podcast expenses are really starting to pile up too. For starters, I've been taking dictation and pronunciation lessons at a finishing school two towns over, and tuition is really expensive. Also, for the first 19 episodes, I was under the impression that I had to use a new microphone for each episode, or people would get bored of the sound of it and unsubscribe. Besides for that, my car's been in the shop after somebody put eggs in the gas tank, so I've been having to rent a car to use as a recording booth for each one of these episodes. I got a bunch of merch made, but I lost it all. Did I mention my lips get chapped from speaking so much while recording so many hours of podcasts? I had to get prescription-strength lip salve, which is $180 an ounce, because my insurance won't cover it. You wouldn't know this, because my podcast is audio only, but I wear waders while making each episode to get me in the right headspace, and I've worn a hole in the butt of three pairs now because of my severe farting problem. I'm going to stop there, because I think you get the picture by now, and I should probably talk a little bit about the Deschutes River. It seems like most people want to fish the Deschutes during the famous salmon fly hatch. And from what I've read and watched while I've been researching this episode, the reason is pretty obvious.
Well, no fucking shit!
Who wouldn't want to spend a day or a few days throwing giant dry flies at beautiful fish with a high desert steep canyon backdrop? The fish are in full-on feast mode, and it doesn't even seem like you need to be an all-star caster or fly tire to get the job done. Sounds right up my alley. The fish are sitting there waiting, drooling at the real salmon flies that fall off the overhanging trees and bushes, and you get to sneak in a phony version and have all the fun while they get pissed at being tricked again. And there's a lot of patterns that'll work. Find a picture of a salmon fly and tie a big ol' honkin' fly with similar colors and make sure it floats, or at least kinda floats. If you want some inspiration, look up flies like the Chubby Chernobyl or the Norm Wood, Clark's Stone, Josh Lynn's MFFR, maybe a Crowd Surfer. There's also the True Salmon Fly or the Rolling Stone. See, there's a bunch. Use your dowsing rods and pick one for the love of God and go get a fish. You might end up with a red band or a steelhead or a whitefish or even a bull trout on the end of your line. My guest Jeremiah goes into more detail during our interview, but there are a few different sections of the Deschutes and they vary a bit. I teased that you can surf the Deschutes at the beginning of the show, so I guess I should explain that. One section of the river includes the Bend Whitewater Park, which consists of 26 air bladders or gates that are permanently affixed to the riverbed to shape whitewater waves for recreation. The park offers opportunities for bodyboarding, surfing, and whitewater kayaking, and it's a year-round attraction. See, I wasn't lying this time. You can surf with rainbow trout on the Deschutes.
Dude, you got the best barrels ever, dude. Just like, you pull in, and you just get spit right out of them. And you just drop in and just smack the lip. Drop down.
You know what does sound like a lie to me? There's an attraction in Bend called the Lava River Cave. And yeah, right, it's just lava tubes. Google that one and look for yourself.
Oh, shit.
Here we go again.
I see an obvious entrance to inner Earth. Let's just go, guys. The time is now. People are flying drones around old Tartarian cathedrals that claim to be some kind of ancient tech to inspect things for themselves.
I came across this collection of maps, and at first I thought it was the United States, or at least the one that we know. But in fact, it was much more than this.
The least we can do is take a walk into a dark tube. Let's get a good old-fashioned neighborhood mob together and get a dozen of those brightest flashlights on Earth from the infomercials and start walking. If we end up meeting some type of creature or a red-headed giant in there, that is a pretty badass way to die, I guess. No, I don't want to do this. I am not a spelunker. Gives me chills just writing about it, actually. I'll be the guy at the mouth of the tunnels acting as home base for radio communications, okay? Guiding a ragtag group of podcast listeners to the truth. People weirder than me love to talk about the last blockbuster in the world being in Bend, but no one talks about the last Hollywood video store that's also in Bend. It's like the infamous Blue Room at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, or the Howard Hughes Aircraft Building Time Travel Jump Room in Los Angeles. Just letting my imagination run wild here, but inside the last Hollywood video store on Earth could be a room that holds the brains of all the dead elites in stasis. Brains that control legions of clones across the globe, born only to do the evil bidding of the ruling elite. I mean, they say that military tech is always at least 50 years ahead of the public, so you can start with the military already having highly advanced drones back in the 50s or 60s, right? That means the drones they have now are 50 years ahead of what is on the public market today, too. Apply that concrete hypothetical logic to cloning, and that mouse that some scientist grew an ear on 25 years ago starts to look kind of scary. So, in my imagination, I end up being the guy who goes into the last Hollywood video store in Bend, Oregon, and the door is just open, and it looks, sounds, and smells just like a video store would, only the aisles no longer hold movies on their shelves. Just brains and jars of liquid with labels on them saying who they are and how many clones they have. And I just start smashing and squishing them with a hammer, and all the clones fall dead at the same time as their mother brains are smushed, like some kind of hive mind, and I'm the hero to everyone left. Which isn't many. Wow, I got way off subject there. If you're still with me, I have another reason why you probably want to head up to Bend. Beer. Bend has lots of breweries, the most in the whole state of Oregon per capita. I'm assuming most of my listener base is made up of people who love to drink cold beers. I'm not even assuming, actually. The analytics and the reports I pull from Spotify for Podcasters provide solid data to back that up. So, there are plenty of places where you can either celebrate your great day on the water, or drown your misery after your long day of getting brutally skunked again. Honestly though, fishing the Deschutes looks like it would be pretty sweet whether you're catching fish or not. Jeremiah Houle was nice enough to spend an hour with me on the computer talking about that river, and Bigfoot, and salmon flies, and a bunch of other things. He knows this river intimately, and I can't thank him enough for coming on the show. We've covered a lot of real info about the geography of the river and its different sections, flies to use, regulations, and all sorts of stuff. I hope you dig our chat.
Right on, man. Well, thanks for letting me steal some of your time. I know we both got kids. I just had meatloaf, and I'm sure you were doing something similar.
Getting everybody fed.
So thanks for letting me steal some precious downtime. I know you're busy, too.
Yeah, very, very welcome, man.
I'm stoked to learn about the Deschutes. It's another river that I haven't fished, that I've read a lot about, always heard about, and it seems kind of unique and cool for steelhead rivers and stuff. And you know, I want to see all of those at some point. But
yeah,
I have some questions before we get there. Like, where are you located right now?
So I'm based in Bend, Oregon. So right in central Oregon here, kind of a fly fishing mecca of Oregon. We've got a ton of rivers, a ton of lakes around. And yeah, I've been up here since 2011. So born in Dunsmuir. And grew up in Redding. So, state of Jefferson all the way up there in Bigfoot country.
Yeah.
Grew up there. So, good stuff.
Dude, I love Dunsmuir. I talk with a buddy of mine, my buddy Steve, about, fantasizing about buying a cabin up there someday, like going on one. And it's such a cool location and so much stuff close by. I love the McLeod too.
Yeah, all those areas there, you know, the upper Sacramento with like 35 miles of walkable river. It's just tough to beat.
Yeah, that's rad. So if you're in Bend, what do you consider your home water? What are you fishing the most up there?
You know, in Bend, for me, I'm typically heading to the Deschutes. That's where we get, it's a little tougher fishery for sure, but that's what brought me up here in the first place. That's, you know, if I'm going to fish in Central Oregon for a day for trout, that's going to be my number one spot.
Nice. So did you move up there for a guide job?
No. So I moved up here pretty much any way I could. So I got a job at Columbia Sportswear. They were the first people to hire me, and I had somewhat of a steady income, and it's a little outlet on the south end of town. I moved up, and then I figured once I got up here, you know, I could, I worked at the fly shop in Reading for a while. Cool. And I figured I can, you know, get into another fly shop or a guide gig. So got up here, started looking around at places. You know, it's funny. I brought my resume to a lot of shops, and, you know, it was funny to see that they look at the resume like, oh, we don't take resumes. I'm like, well, I mean, do you have an application? Like, yeah. Can I talk to somebody? And finally, there's an Orvis company store here, and I went in there and started talking with them and got hired there. And then there was an outfitter that worked with that store, because, of course, that store doesn't have an outfitting license. So I got on board in early 2012 with Deep Canyon Outfitters, and that's where I kind of cut my teeth here in Central Oregon.
Cool, man. Yeah. Well, how did you get into tying flies then? Like how early on in your fly fishing did you start tying your own stuff?
Pretty early. So I started at the fly shop in Reading when I was 17, and I'd already been kind of tying a little bit. I can tie green rock worms and zebra midges, and, you know, Copper John was like upper echelon of my tying. Mm-hmm. And then you walk into the fly shop and there's, you know, Tim Fox, Bill Martz, you have Justin Miller, who's a fantastic, you know, steel and salmon tire, all these very, very, Mike Mercer, I almost forgot that guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he has so many great, great, talented tires. I'm sure they were so fed up with my ass by week two of, hey, how do you do this? And what do you do here? And the 17-year-old kid still in high school that's just running around like a chicken with his head cut off. And yes, I started early. Being in Dunsmuir, we had Ted Faye's Fly Shop.
Yeah.
So, you know, I still have a pack of the neon green Caddis dubbing that I got from his shop. Yeah, that
it's a rad shop. It's a rad little shop. Yeah. It's weird. Like the few times I've been in there, it feels like I'm always the only person in there. Like I picked the time like that nobody else is in. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. So it's funny. Before they were at that location, kind of on the main drag, they were like a side room on a hotel on the north end of town.
I didn't know that.
It was the dirtiest little fly shop, and I fell in love immediately.
Right on, man. So, you know, you mentioned you're starting to guide on the Deschutes. Is there something unique you have to do to get a guide license with it being on a reservation or anything like that?
So no. And honestly, in Oregon and in almost everywhere that I'm aware of, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, or not Alaska, there's a place in Alaska where you need, you know, different stuff, but California, Oregon, Washington, if you have a heartbeat and you can row a boat, you're going to get a guide license as long as that check clears. So, you know, I wish there was some type of test to say, hey, like, can you tie a knot? Can you cast 50 feet? You know, something, but there isn't. The interesting thing about that reservation is that it's for a certain part of the river.
Okay.
And it's for just that west bank. So, as you're floating down river left for a while, it is closed. There are certain parts that you can buy permits for that you can actually go over there, walk around, park your boat, fish. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting river. Kind of the way that river flows is it starts, you know, up in the Cascade Mountain Range, just south of Bachelor. And it kind of flows south for a little bit and then does a U-turn and goes through the town of Sun River and flows north. So it's a pretty interesting river. You'll be, you know, talking to clients in the morning and you're pointing north and saying, hey, we're going down river. Yeah, and they kind of look at you like, what do you mean? Like downriver south, you know? And so it's definitely an interesting river. The, you know, kind of the whole idea of the Deschutes, where people have this thought of it being this massive, massive river. You know, all those things are true. There's a lot of water flowing in there. The canyon walls, of course, are impressive. But once you get in that canyon, you know, it's funny. It feels pretty intimate. Still, yeah, even though it's so big.
Yeah, you get that feeling just watching videos.
Yeah.
Like I just watched one, what is it, Todd Mowens?
Oh, yeah.
He did for Catch Magazine.
Yeah.
And the first thing that you always think of, at least for me, because I haven't been there, when you picture the Deschutes, are those big canyon walls for sure.
Yeah.
There's so many awesome rivers in Oregon, you know, like the Rogue, the Sandy, the Umpqua, the Willamette. Yeah. Like, I mean, there's a ton of them. Like, what else besides what we already said? Like, is there anything else that sets the Deschutes apart, different from those?
You know, the big deal is being that you can't fish out of a boat.
Yeah, so that's one thing I didn't know when I was reading about that too. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's an interesting one. You know, you get the typical fly fishing client that does a trip in Montana, maybe Idaho. He's used to hopping in the boat. All right, which side do you want me to cast? And that was something we made very clear with the start. You know, hey, I want to fish the Deschutes. Perfect. Are you okay waiting? Nope, I want to fish out of a boat. Okay, we're not talking about the Deschutes then. So being able to get out of the boat and wade was a limitation for a lot of clients. They can't do it. And so, yeah, it's an interesting conversation. And then for me, I grew up in Redding, California. So we had the lower Sacramento, big tailwater, fishing out of little, you know, fiberglass drift boats. And then when you show up to the Deschutes, you notice big aluminum drift boats, a big Koffler or Willie 17-foot drift boats, kind of standard with two seats up front. And so very unique. There's, I'm not positive of a lot of other rivers that have that rule. I know some places like the Olympic Peninsula, there's certain stretches you can't fish out of a boat.
I was going to say, I know they did that on some of the rivers, or maybe just parts of rivers, you know, recently.
Yeah, but I mean, for the entirety of the river, the lower Deschutes River, that's pretty unique. So when I first got here, it was frustrating. If you were guiding and you're guiding clients out of a boat, if they couldn't put pressure on a fish, well, I'm going to start back rowing. And all of a sudden, boom, we've got pressure on that fish. Sure. We're going to land that fish of the trip. Or if it starts taking off and you see the client do the death grip, I'm going to start pushing my ass forward.
Yeah.
And we're going to chase that fish down. On the Deschutes, all those options are gone.
Why was that? I mean, I don't know when that started. Do you know why and when? Or,
you know, I've heard 50 different stories. It's not a navigable waterway. That's bull. They were running
safety was a concern or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, even then there's a stretch, we call it the day stretch. It's from Warm Springs to Trout Creek, and it's a 7 or 8 mile stretch. And it is as calm as can be. Like, you have to work to sink a boat in that. So, I mean, you look at that and you're like, no, safety is not an issue. I can do this thing backwards with four clients and be fine. You know, I do think it has something to do with the reservation, right? Because if you could fish out of a boat, there'd be no way that they can have that special part of the river, right? You just float over there and start fishing your way down, and that, you know, nothing would happen. So I think that has a lot to do with it. But I've heard, like I said, 50 different stories of why it was and wasn't. For me, I just think it's because of that, you know, keeping that part of the reservation special.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I know the OP stuff was all based on fish numbers and stuff, right? Like preserving what were low fish counts. I mean,
exactly.
I don't know the exact details. Just
I think the mentality there was that, you know, once those steelhead get up that far, you know, they're going to try to find some refuge in places. If you get a fish that's trying to, you know, get out of a swell and kind of hang out for a little bit, they can have that refuge instead of, you know, having flies or whatever else coming down and getting them. So I think that was the reason why they did it in Washington. Here it's, you know, that has nothing to do with trout fishing, right? Trout numbers are great. Sure. Everybody catches a bunch of trout. Those, you know, you can't trout fish out of the boat either. That's great because, you know, for a lot of folks, you have to work your butt off. There's a stretch on the lower part of the Deschutes, the last 25 miles, that you can run jet boats during certain periods. And to be honest, I'm not super familiar with that program. I never had a jet boat down there. I wasn't running that program. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are certain stretches where you can, but still you can't fish out of a boat. You have to go from spot to spot, which I didn't like it at first. Towards the end of my guiding career there, I absolutely loved it. It was such a cool experience to have, you know, the people get out, you really fish hard, and then get back in the boat. They can relax, crack open a beer, kick the feet up, you know. So when we get to that next spot, they hop out, they're spry, they're ready to go. They can actually make good cast. And
there's some planning. Planning discussions going on before you get there and figuring things out.
You get your client and if they're having a trouble getting into your truck in the morning, you start, that spot's gone. That spot's gone. Yeah. We hope that grandma's not at this spot, because that's going to ruin our day.
It sounds cool to me. I haven't fished a river where that was the case. But you know, I rarely fish from boats, and it sounds cool. I like the taxi concept of it, you know, like, yeah. would you support that happening on more rivers? Like after guiding on the Deschutes that way for what, 8 years?
No, not at all. I think it's so limiting, you know. Yeah. You look at Missoula, Montana, right? Very similar to Bend, weather wise, everything, like cool little town, tons of tourists. You have a river that runs right through town. You've got a wave park. I mean, you name it. There's so many similarities. And if you walk into a fly shop in February, there's people wanting to fish, right? You know, for us, if somebody called in February and said, "Hey, man, I want to go fish," we have one river, the Fall River, that was good, maybe the Crooked River, but they're all walk and wade fisheries. So you're having to get into waders and you're having to get into the water, which when it's February and it's, you know, 30 degrees out, if you're in a drift boat, you can be nice and toasty, right? You can bundle up, you're fine. When you start getting into the water, that's when you start really, really cooling down. So I feel like it limits what this fishing community could be by quite a bit.
So, I mean, there's wild steelhead in the Deschutes, right?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like how are they getting to the ocean and back? Like what's, I mean, it seems kind of deep.
Yes. You know? I guess let's talk about the river. So I said it kind of flows out a little lava lake. It's an aquifer, right? So the lake is there. And then there's an outlet. There's no inlets to that lake, which is really neat. So you have this, you know, outlet that starts the Deschutes, and that's the Upper Deschutes River. The Upper Deschutes River, in a lot of places, if you're a damn good jumper, you can jump across it. Tiny, tiny, tiny water. Of course, wild rainbows. They do have some brook trout up there. They do have some brown trout up there. It's a wonderful fishery. It's such a contrast to what most people think of the Deschutes. So flows south for a while, does that U-turn, the Fall River dumps in, and the Fall River is a spring creek, gin clear. If you've looked up, you know, anything in Central Oregon, there's been something about the Fall River. Historically, it's had a lot of hatchery influence, so it's a fun place to go if you're getting into fishing and or you need to scratch that itch, right? It's February, you've been looking at snow for, you know, 2 months, and there's a break in the weather. Go to the Fall River, have fun, catch some round tails, and, you know, have a great time.
Yeah.
So it continues flowing north at that point. When it gets to about Bend, that's where it goes from kind of the Upper Deschutes is what we call it, to the Middle Deschutes. So the Middle Deschutes is from Bend all the way down to Lake Billy Chinook. And in that stretch, you're going to have...
I love that name, Lake Billy Chinook.
Yeah, Lake Billy Chinook. It's a good one. You know, you have... It's very freestone-esque, is the best way to describe it. Big boulders. If anybody's fished the Pitt River in Northern California, they have an idea. But imagine just a micro shrunk down lower Deschutes. So a lot of places have those big canyon walls, except the river is flowing, you know, a quarter of what it is down to lower. So really fun. We've got rainbows, of course, the Deschutes Red Band, brown trout in there. We do have bull trout in there as well. So that dumps into Lake Billy Chinook, where you have the Crooked River to the east and then the Metolius River to the west. So it kind of looks like a three prong that comes into this lake. And then from there, you start the Lower Deschutes River. So it goes into a little Lake Sintestis, and then it goes from there to the Lower Deschutes. So the Lower Deschutes, I break it down into two parts. You have the lower and then the lower. So for us, the lower Deschutes,
the lowest.
The deep lower. You know, all of us Bend guides, for the most part, we're spending a lot of time on that Warm Springs area, which is the uppermost put in that you can do, flowing down to the town of Maupin. So within that, you have the Warm Springs boat ramp, Trout Creek boat ramp, which is about 8 miles down from there. We call that the day stretch. It's an easy day float, plenty of water to get out and fish. Our salmon fly hatch is probably, I don't know, three weeks away. And, you know, that's a great place to, if you have a day to go fish, perfect, go do it. Once again, you're fishing, you know, from shore, so you're getting out of the boat. During that stretch, there's a part on that tribal side that if you buy a tribal permit, you can hop out, you can fish, you can walk the trail. So it opens up quite a bit of water. From there, you go, once you pass Trout Creek, if you're done for the day trip, you're good to go. From Trout Creek down to the town of Maupin, the float that I did most often was a camp trip. So we put in, we have 3-4 days to get it done. It's a 35-ish mile stretch, and you have class four, you have class three. It's a serious investment in time and oarsmanship. So it keeps a ton of people away. We would do 4-day trips where you'd start at Warm Springs. You'd fish Warm Springs at Trout Creek, which gets quite a bit of pressure because of its ease. It's a short day float, very easy rowing, all that stuff. It gets quite a bit of pressure. And then from Trout Creek down, it changes completely. The fishery is so much better. I feel like there's 10 times the amount of fish, and it's probably just because of the pressure, but you know, the fish quality is great. It's just, it's a really, really fun time when you start floating down. You know, there's no public access. You know, there's a couple spots. You have South Junction area, which is a spot that you can, you know, drive into, but technically you're not supposed to cross the tracks. So, you know, there's really no public access once you get past Trout Creek all the way down to, you know, we would float all the way down to Harpham Flat Campground typically, but Nina Campground, you'll start seeing more boats. And then on that right side, there'll be a small stretch that people can hike up to. But honestly, not the best fishing on that, the Locked Gate area, it's called. I've done it. I never liked it. It's a lot of hiking, not a lot of good fishing. So yeah, that 35 mile stretch was something special. So from there, there's this little stretch that I call the splash and giggle section. So you have, it's no more boat permits. It's unlimited boat permits. You're getting out on a 3 or 4 day camp trip. You fished your ass off, you know, you're sunburnt, you're exhausted, dehydrated, probably from drinking too many beers and not enough water. You get there to this boat ramp and there's bus loads of, you know, people in swimsuits. You have, you know, rafts stacked six high. And it's just this big splashy whitewater zone from there down quite a ways. It starts again. You can get down, you know, for me, it was, I really started again towards Beaver Tail. So Beaver Tail is the next boat ramp that I liked. You can do stuff up higher. For me, Beaver Tail all the way down to the mouth was where I like to focus my time on. And that's where you get a lot of the great steelhead numbers. Okay. So in the middle of that stretch from the splash and giggle to Beaver Tail, you have not even a rapid, it's a waterfall called Shears Falls. Right. And, you know, for whatever reason, you'd have so many steelhead that come up the Columbia and take a right-hand turn into the Deschutes because it's colder. And that same steelhead might go to the John Day. He might go to Idaho. He might go to 50 other rivers, but he's going to come into the Deschutes and be able to get caught, you know, during that stretch. So, yeah. You've got a lot of buddies that guide down there, and the steelhead fishing is light years different down there than it is up top. So
the waterfall you're talking about is a barrier that they can't cross.
Yeah, they can cross it. That Shears Falls, they crossed it for, you know, years and years and years before humans were around. You know, then they did build a little fish passage around it to make it easier, but man, you know,
yeah,
a lot of years where those steelhead and salmon were jumping up over those waterfalls, no problem.
I'm always super curious about the route, you know, these fish have to take to get to these spots. And I've always been super interested in these camp trips, which you see a lot in that part of the state. I feel like you see them on the Grand Ronde and stuff like that. On one of your camp trips, what does that totally entail? Like, what kind of food are you bringing? Like, what's the situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's the float and bloat, right? You're going to gain some weight, definitely. You know, it's going to be really high quality meals. When I first started, so say it was you and a buddy, and you wanted to do a camp trip on the Deschutes. Typically, you'd be in a guide boat. Obviously, we'd meet at the boat ramp in the morning. All of your gear that was stuff that needed to go to camp, your sleeping bag, change of clothes, whatever else, that gets put in a we call it a bagger, but it's a gear guide, camp guide, whatever you want to call him. His, you know, your dry bag goes in his boat. He would leave first thing off in the morning. He goes down river to get a camp. That's his job. And
you have like a convoy. You're not going out there, you and like a regular day guiding you in a couple
days. I mean, you know, most places it's you know, four anglers is a minimum just to make that work out, right? So you put the gear in his boat, he takes off, he's gonna go get the camp, and then you hop in the guide's boat and you start floating down fishing, having a great time. The one thing that's pretty unique here on the Deschutes was you know, it gets to lunchtime, we're gonna pull over at a spot and we're gonna grill up some burgers or, you know, some chicken brie sandwiches or, you know, something, and take a break, eat some food, you know, kind of relax a little bit, and then hop back in the boats and continue the day. You get down towards the end of the day and you pull up to a camp that has, you know, covered dining areas. You've got tents set up that have cots and sleeping pads in it. So typically two customers per tent, unless there's somebody that snores like crazy, they get their own tent in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, you get everybody set up. There's appetizers waiting for you, and then great food, great drinks, great entertainment. You're right on the water. So, you know, after dinner, if you feel like you need to go catch another fish, you're right there. It's super fun. And then you wake up the next day, do it all over again. So breakfast, continue down. And so, you know, typically done in 3 to 4 days to make it, you know, really nice. But you're able to enjoy yourself, take your time. And that was one thing that I really appreciate is that as you're floating down, you know, say you're on the lower Sacramento, you're so focused on what you're doing because you're moving, right? You are floating down river. You have to get ready for that strike, whether it's a dry fly or an indicator or whatever else. You have to be ready to you know, get after that fish. Well, here we fish our asses off and then we hop in a boat and then we start floating down, get some water, get whatever else you need. As we're floating down, you're going to see golden eagles, bighorn sheep, mule deer, all the awesome stuff that Central Oregon's known for. So yeah, you get to see that, enjoy yourself, and then, hey, we're going to pull over here and start fishing hard again. I think that uniqueness of not being able to fish out of the boat really makes that trip special. I mean, it's tough fishing, no doubt about it. You know, it's not the easiest wading. You know, you have to be a little bit on your game. You can't just come in there and not know what end of a fly rod to hold and expect to catch a dozen fish a day. Yeah. But those fish are extremely hard fighting. They, you know, everybody uses the expression like footballs, and then they pull up a picture and it's like, oh man, that's a snake. What are you talking about? These things are definitely fat, thick shouldered, and the coloration on them, it's hard to describe, but it's like an olive bronze color over the back.
Sorry to cut you off. I was going to ask you about unique characteristics on these fish because of this route, and I totally forgot. So thank you for bringing
this. You know, the steelhead for sure. You know, they look like that typical high desert summer steelhead. I apologize. I was talking trout there. But yeah, you know, the trout are olive bronze over the back. They've got this maroonish purple red cheek to them. You know, they're a darker looking fish overall. And I think it has a lot to do with that sun being up. You know, they can't be a bright, you know, shiny silver fish. Yeah. Or Mr. Osprey is going to get them pretty easy. So, you know, the steelhead, when they first get in, if you're fishing down that lower stretch, beaver tail all the way down the mouth, you'll get fish that are chrome bright. I mean, no doubt about it. He's on the move. That fish is ready to go. And then as they're in the system longer, they'll start to get that faint olive. They might, you know, gain a few spots. And then that nice blush on their cheeks. And then getting into like October, November, you'll start to see those fish get a little bit darker. They'll get into that war paint, right? So they'll have those, you know, red bands on them, those big red stripes for the males, and kind of look like they're getting ready to do their business.
You know, you brought up that focus part of this, right? When you're when you tell people that you fish, you know, that you like fishing, they're like, oh, it's so relaxing, right? You're like, yeah. And that's kind of like how I always taken it. But, you know, I was just talking to my psychiatrist earlier before I talked to you. And I was telling him how I stopped going to therapy. I didn't like it. It was depressing and stuff. And I'm finding other outlets. You know, fishing is something I do to help me with that, right? And play music too. And one thing that I kind of recently just kind of came upon, and it's probably really obvious for most people, it wasn't so obvious for me, because like I said, you think of fishing as just relaxing, but that focus part of it is key, right? With music, for me, playing in like a band or with other people, when you're playing that stuff, you really can't think of anything else, right? You have to focus on what you're doing so that you're like in the pocket with the rest of the band or whatever, right? And you're saying the same thing about when you're out with a guide and you're in a technical fishery or something like that, you have to be focused and paying attention to all those little things. And that's how those other, that's how the rest of the bullshit leaves. Right. So it's not just like relaxing, but that, you know, the focus part is key. I just realized that.
Yeah. You're really, really good point. And I feel like that's true with a lot of outdoor activities or hobbies, right? Like if you're a photographer, like, yeah, you can put it on auto and click some photos and like, oh yeah, cool. I'm a photographer, right? I love photography. Or you can be a little more focused and make those micro adjustments and really have great photos. And for me, it's the same thing with fly fishing. You can go over there, mess around, flop around, you might catch a fish, or you can focus and make those micro adjustments. And all of a sudden, you know, yeah, you're getting a lot of fish and it's a lot of fun. And, you know, you're able to kind of fine tune those things pretty, pretty easy. So yeah, that's kind of the guiding part for me in a nutshell was that whole program. You know, the seasons are pretty unique. So the Deschutes closes down for a certain point on that upper stretch. You know, it starts back April 22nd. So really, really just kicked off a little bit ago. A lot of my buddies that are around all winter, ready to grab a beer, grab some lunch, are now MIA. They're on the river for the next, you know, month and a half straight. And you know, we start off, it's going to be your typical early spring fishing, right? Big nymphs, typically big stonefly nymphs. And those stoneflies are starting to migrate. So stoneflies, they want that length of day. They want to have that water temperature. There's all these little micro factors that come in and they start, hey, it's my time to go party. So they start migrating to the edges of the river. And at that point, I feel like every fish in the river follows them, right? They know what's happening. And so the fishing can be phenomenal. Weather, it's roll the dice, man. You know, a week and a half ago, I had about a half inch of snow on my truck. You know, a couple of days ago, it was 80 degrees. So spring is always a crapshoot in Central Oregon. But if you can get out there and have a good, I mean, it's just the most amazing time when there's nobody there. You might see another boat on that 35-mile stretch.
So rad.
Once, you know, the 7th to the 10th of May, that's typically when your stoneflies start getting active for that upper stretch. And that's when, you start seeing, you better get there real early. You know, you better get in front of people and
everybody shows up.
It's funny because that hatch starts lower in the river where the water's warm and it works its way up river. Right. So my buddies are, you know, probably starting to find, you know, stoneflies down in the lower river. They're not going to be up top for another 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, right? So that keeps transitioning up. And then there's a certain point where, you know, you get down below Shears Falls and it's almost exclusively golden stones. You see very few salmon flies. And then once you start working your way up, it starts to get to a mix and then, you know, gets more heavy. Typically for me is more heavy salmon fly up at the top where it's a little bit colder year round. That's what those salmon flies like. So there's
the salmon fly is a stone fly too, right?
Yeah, so both of the stoneflies, you know, that family, you got the squalla, you know, you got all those other bugs in there, the flightless stone that pops out in August for us here. But yeah, the stonefly, you know, genre, you have the salmon fly, which is the biggest. That's that brown with that rust burnt orange color bands on it. Yeah. And that's the, you can't tie them big enough, honestly. Like, I stopped tying them too big because if you want to get to the actual size of that bug, the size of fish that can eat that is pretty damn big. And so you're not catching a lot of fish. Yeah. You'll see it, you know, fish come up, push the fly out of its mouth. Yeah. Then you have the golden stone, which is that beautiful, you know, yellowish, you know, golden brown color. It's an interesting color here. And then, you know, squalls are going to be that early riser. And that's going to be, that olive color, like a dark olive. But for us, you know, for the most of the folks during that stonefly hatch, they're going for salmon fly and golden stones. And so you start off your trips, you know, early. You might be fishing indicators or high stick nymphing or whatever you like to do. And the first day, that might be all you do. And the second day, the first hour, you're doing that, and all of a sudden, bugs are there. And so for me, I would typically start the 22nd of April, and I would end the 10th of June or so. And I'd pretty much be going back to back camp trip straight. So 3 and 4 days back to back to back to back. It's a lot of work for sure, but the amount of rest you get on the water is really nice. And for me, I knew exactly where those bugs were. So we can adjust where we're camping. We can adjust, you know, a bunch of things to be able to stay in that hatch the entirety of the trip, which was really fun. And then, yeah, so there'll be a big stretch where I've got dry fly rods in the boat. You can't find an indicator. And if somebody wants to throw an indicator, it's like, no, buddy, we don't have to do it. We're going to get so many great opportunities with this one single dry fly. You know, you don't have to.
Don't even need like a dropper off it ever. Just the dry fly.
No, yeah. Like you'll see, you know, I would say that, and this is not talking about, you know, any other outfitter, but you'd see outfitters you don't normally see down there during the stonefly hatch, right? They're going to come, they're going to try to make some hay. During that time, you'll see them with big chubby Chernobyl, 6 feet to a Pertajon, and they're fishing riffles.
Yeah.
It's like, man, that's not the stonefly hatch. You know, this is supposed to be combat fishing. So it was short leaders, you know, 7.5 foot, 2X leaders. And we're fishing underneath trees. A big cast might be 20 feet. And then, yeah, just catching a bunch of fish on dry flies. Man, doesn't get much better.
Radical. Yeah, I've never fished like that. I mean, I don't fish a whole lot of dry flies really at all. And, you know, it always baffles me when you have these big hatches and you're throwing something phony in the middle of all these real bugs. Like what do you do to set your you know, your dry fly out, apart from the rest of the stuff there?
Yeah, I see. It's not like a caddis hatch, right? Where you have blankets of bugs rising up and hatching out. These the stoneflies will crawl out onto limbs or rocks and hatch, climb up into something else to kind of dry their wings and hang out for a while. And it might be, you know, a day or two before they start flying around. And so it's very opportunistic. So you have to be in a good spot and you don't have to see rises. Like you can go to a spot and there's nothing rising. And I'm like, we're going to get 2 fish out of this spot. And your client's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You go in there and yeah, that bug hits the water and it's opportunity and that fish eats it. So yeah, that's,
it's just reading the water like regular, you know where these fish are going to sit just based on, you know.
Yeah. And it's different. So, I mean, you want to be underneath limbs, underneath trees, you know, the stone flies, they do ovipause. They will drop eggs on the water, but a lot of the stuff I was fishing was, you know, a bug comes dislodged and falls into the water. You know, there's branches around, there's grass around. That's the stuff I focused on. But yeah, it's different reading the water, right? It's not riffles and runs and seams and stuff like that. It's, hey, where's the tightest spot I can fit a fly into and guarantee there's a fish up there waiting for something to drop.
Man, sounds so cool. What kind of setup for like a two-handed rod? Like, well, like, is it more of like a trout spay?
You know, I did very little trout spay when I was guiding. I stopped guiding in 2019. You know, for me, that trout spay is kind of just taking off at that point, and you had good lines, good rods that actually made it, you know, worth it. There were rods that were around. You know, you'd have a 6 weight from X company. And like, yeah, you know, 6 weight, you need 500 grains to load it. You're like, what are you talking about, man? That's so overkill. That's not going to feel like a 6 weight. So I feel like now we do have rods that are in lines, which are really important, that are matched for it. But if you're wanting a trout spay, you know, I typically use the Scientific Angler's Spay Light series because it's integrated and I can strip my fly all the way into the leader, which makes it really nice.
Out that little bump. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then for steelhead, I mean, our steelhead, I really like 6 weights out there. I think that's a great, great line weight. 7 weight, if you have wind or you're fishing sink tips, but you can fish Scandinavian style lines. So very light lines, you know, sonar leaders. So you're not fishing heavy tips, heavy flies. I mean, light traditional flies, maybe, you know, you have to get a foot underneath the surface, but for the most part, you can stay pretty high up, and as long as you're in the shade, those steelhead are going to grab that fly.
Dude, yeah, I got to get up there. I mean, everything I was watching is all about the salmon hatch, so it must be good. You know,
it's good. I would say that come June 10th, there's more caddis around. You're fishing the same. You can fish the same style. It's so much less crowded. I preferred, you know, the caddis hatch for myself. just because of that reason alone. You know, rivers to yourself.
Yeah.
You got every one of your favorite spots are available, and you can fish some pretty unique water that way.
You start talking shit on all these salmon flies. Who needs these? Who needs the salmon flies?
Exactly. But the cool thing is, man, they get supercharged, right? They've just been eating steak dinners and just super high protein for a month. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they get pretty yoked pretty quick.
Is it like a guide's rite of passage that you have to eat a big salmon fly? Do you ever eat one of those?
No, I haven't. You know, I feel like some people do it just to beat their chest a little bit and, you know, good for them. They're, you know,
yeah, no,
guides,
you.
First and foremost are entertainers. So, you know, sometimes it's inevitable.
Man. Yeah. That's a big crunchy one. No, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Remove the wings is my tip,
man,
for you.
Man,
yeah.
Even then, gross, man.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we talked a whole bunch about stone flies and stuff, using sink tips and things. What other flies, like what do you think would be, what were the main like guide flies that you were tying guiding there? And like what are a couple other patterns that you think people should have if they're going up to the Deschutes?
I tell people this with a story. So I had a log every time during steelhead season, and I remember getting done with the steelhead season and going through and reading a bunch and doing tallies, and I'm like, man, there's this one fly. It's a super simple fly. It's tied on a bronze Alec Jackson size 5, I want to say, a little bit of pheasant crest, a little bit of a gold tinsel butt, and then claret dubbing with pretty thick gold ribbing, gold tinsel ribbing, white calf tail or polar bear if you got it, and then a couple turns of block schlopping, right? I fished that fly a ton, and I got done at the end of my guide season. I'm like, man, this fly crushed, absolutely crushed for me. And I started reading, I'm like, yeah, it's because that's all I fished. Like, a steelhead is going to grab it, right?
They love it.
In my guide box, I had typically 3 flies. It was going to be that one. Well, 4 flies. The steelhead coachman, John Hazel pattern, it's great. It's a drab pattern. That pattern I just described. And then my green butt unskunked. This is one that I
tied. Unskunked. What's the unskunked? Yeah. What is this?
So, so it's tied on that... the steelhead irons in a size 3. So it's a little bit heavier wire. For me, it was, you know, green holographic tinsel for the, you know, green butt part. It was red, pheasant tippet, and then black UV ice dub with, some pearl tinsel as that wrap. Cool. And then it went black calf tail with black schlopping in front of the calf tail. So more of a drab pattern, unskunked, of course, having that dual purpose, right? Mm-hmm. The big white wing was the green butt skunk. So removing that white wing, going to black.
Okay. All right.
And then, yeah, that was such a successful fly for me. I really enjoyed that one. And then this Sylvanator tube. So Brian Sylvie, absolute genius on the Deschutes. You know, he's a reason why a lot of those guides down there, myself included, had a job. Mm-hmm. But, you know, essentially it's black rabbit strip. You got a couple pieces of ostotril on both sides, some schlopping, and a bead of your choice. So for me, I like the egg sucking or the black and blue, those two color combos. If I did have to put a sink tip on and get down a little bit, that was it. And, you know, when I was guiding, if somebody's like, man, do you think I should change my fly? Yes, mm-hmm. I think you should, because at that point you've lost confidence in it. I'd open up my box and pick whatever you want, and, you know, to have different sizes and different, you know, maybe one be more sparse or one thicker, but they pick one out and all of a sudden they've got this renewed energy. Steelhead, Eric Leininger says it best, you know, they're not hard to catch. They're hard to find, right? So there's not a lot of them. Typically, if you get your fly in front of a fish, they're going to grab it. Not all the time. You know, there's rules to every you know deal. For the most part, if we got a fly in front of a fish, you know, didn't matter what it was, they were going to eat it. So have confidence in your fly, tie them well, right? We don't lose them, so tie them well.
I didn't hear you mention a whole lot of bright colors, so typically kind of more subdued stuff, or is that just your preference?
Yeah, it was my preference. That, yeah. You know, and for me, I feel like if 15 people in front of you are fishing a bright hot pink fly and purple, if you come through with something a little more natural, you know, they'll come and grab it. I've stood up on high banks and I've watched a steelhead chase a fly down, you know, 40 feet in a swing, come up and, you know, U-turn a couple times and finally nail it at the end. And on a drab small fly. For me, it wasn't a confidence thing having to move to a big, you know, pink and purple. And like there's summer steelhead, right? It's gin clear water. The one interesting part is that those fish, because the river flows north, those fish are facing directly into the sun. So you know, you definitely have to fish shade, you know, rocky areas for sure. But I had confidence in those colors and I did well.
Yeah, I like that move. Yeah. If they're asking you to change, then yeah, yes is the answer. I mean,
yeah, of course.
I'm out fishing solo usually, and I ask myself that all the time, and I'd be changing flies all the time. So I usually I'll bring two or three, because I'll go for a couple hours or something like that, and I don't want to think about it. I'll just pick one that I feel like is going to do it. But
And you know, it's funny, you see some guides and you look at their fly and you're like, that is the most disgusting cat throw up I've ever seen in my life. And like, they've got confidence in it. Yeah. And that's the most important part, right? Like they're, each mend is perfect. They're right in the zone where they should be. Like, great. Good on you. Just have confidence in it. They're going to grab it if they're there.
Yeah. So we talked about the camp trip where, you know, you're going out and you're dedicated with a guide for 3 or 4 days. What about somebody going out there solo that wants to fish the area for like 3 or 4 days? What, you mentioned a whole bunch of other that I've read about, like the Metolius, right? Like which other ones would you hit if you had a couple of days up there?
Man, it really depends on what you like to do. So the Metolius is great. It is some of the tougher fishing we have in the state just because of the low fish numbers, and it is cold water, deep currents. You know, it's a tough fishery. There are beautiful red bands in there and bull trout. So, you know, you do have the opportunity of hooking a really big bull trout, which is exciting. So that's one that I feel like most people, if they come up here, check it off your list, have some fun. But one of the cool parts about the Deschutes is the wide open availability for camping. So I told you, I typically guide in that stretch that didn't have public access, but in between Warm Springs and Trout Creek, you can hike, get down towards Maupin, even more opportunities to camp. So that's a really unique part, is that you can fish, have a great, great time, get down to camp, you know, relax, hang out, enjoy yourself. Our lakes are also definitely a boat needed, but our lakes are some pretty tremendous fisheries. You know, whether it's you know, big wild rainbows you like going for, brown trout, you name it, phenomenal dry fly fishing, streamer fishing. The list goes on. So there's plenty of opportunities. Like I said, I stopped guiding in 2019 and moved into a sales rep role. So I'm kind of out of the guide scene, but it's amazing the amount of fisheries that are in an hour and a half or 2 hours. So, if you can spend 4 days up here, you know, get a new spot every day, make sure you visit one of the great breweries. I think we have like 80 of them in town now.
Yeah.
Bend has 90 something thousand people and over 20 breweries. So great food, great beer, great fishing. It's a tough place to live.
Yeah. Well, did you guide any other rivers besides the Deschutes?
Yeah, so I did the Metolius, Crooked, Fall River, Sandy M. I did the Clackamas, and I had a few coastal rivers I did for a short while. You know, for me, being in Bend, it's tough to go, you know, 5 hours and you know, spend 2 weeks there and then come back. So the Deschutes is my bread and butter. I think my last year I guided full-time. I did 98 days in the Deschutes Canyon. So definitely spent quite a bit of time there. I really enjoyed it.
Awesome, man. Yeah. And so you just mentioned you're a sales rep for like every fly fishing company. I joke, but you have a lot on your plate, I think, like between Orvis Scientific Anglers, Loon, Riversmith, Aquaflies, probably more.
Just brought on Bahio sunglasses. So really excited for that. I've been wearing their shades for a little while now. And really excited for those guys.
That's
Northwest.
Jay Johnson works with them too, right?
He does. Yeah.
Been wanting to interview him, but I can't get a hold of him. I might have to hit you up.
You know, I'm low man on the totem pole right now, but maybe I can send something out. Yeah.
I'll have to bug you later about that.
Perfect.
So any new products or fly patterns or anything coming out that you're excited about? Or?
Oh man, so it's crazy in the trout spay world with aquaflies. I feel like if I blink, there's 5 new patterns. It's such a revolutionary deal where I feel like at first people went, we need to shrink down massive steelhead flies.
Yeah, shrink them all.
Trout sizes.
Yeah.
And then, there's been a few people, Marcus Mattioli and a few others, that are like, wait, the woolly bugger has caught more trout than, you know, any other fly in the world. So why don't we make a woolly bugger into a spay, you know, style woolly bugger? So class that, you know, woolly bugger up a little bit. And so that's been really exciting. You know, the lines, like I said, the spay light lines are really fun because they're down all the way to like 150 grains, right? So even if you have a single hander, you can still trout spay with your 9-foot 5-weight, catch plenty of fish. So that's been a really, really fun kind of shift in it, right? So our steelhead numbers are down. We're hoping for a steelhead season every year. I feel like the people that really enjoy spay casting really enjoy feeling that tight line grab, that yank. They can still go out. They're going to grab a 3 or a 4 weight now. And now everything's just shrunken down, but they're still getting ripper fish. They're getting, you know, 16, 18, sometimes 20 inch fish, which on the Deschutes is about tops. If you hear anybody say they got a 24 inch fish on the Deschutes, a trout, they're full of it. I guided for 8 full seasons up here. Doesn't happen. You know, 20 inch Deschutes red band is about as big as it gets, but on a 4-weight trout spay, you might see your backing, man. Yeah, it's a blast. Yep.
Right on, man. Well, you know, with Orvis, I had an Orvis zip up merino wool cardigan that was like probably my most comfortable thing I've ever worn. And I've been seriously bummed out about it. They stopped selling them. Like, I don't know what it is. They just, it was gone one day. It seemed like it was always there, and I had a couple of them. And now I hopelessly search eBay for people selling them.
I'm very thankful I don't have to be in that realm. So for me, I'm very focused on that high-end technical fishing gear. So, you know, we've got some great pieces, whether it's insulation pieces, rain gear, waders, tech shirts, right? Some of our tech shirts are absolutely awesome. So, I'm far removed from the merino wool zip ups for the most part. I know that every fall they come out with something that's going to be a nice merino wool comfy zip up.
There was some about that one. It was 3/4 zip, big hardy zipper. It was like a perfect layer, you know, awesome. in there. But you know, I'll just keep looking on eBay.
There you go. Yeah. If I come across one, I'll let you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I probably wrote him a letter at some point. I mean, I was really bummed.
Good.
I think I got chewed up by my dog or something like that. I can't remember the last one I had.
Yeah.
Well, so you mentioned that you've heard my show, so you know I'm going to ask you about paranormal experiences. Have you had anything? I heard you mention Bigfoot like right off the bat.
Yeah, man. You know, being in Bigfoot country, there's I fish a lot on the Trinity River, which
I just interviewed Mario from Taco Flyco, and we talked about the Trinity. I love the Trinity.
Yeah. I mean, there's been plenty of times there where you're up at dark going down to your steelhead run, and you get to your spot and you're getting ready, and all of a sudden, you know, the hair on the back of your neck stands up a little bit, and you hear some big footprints or a howl, and I mean, it's there. If it's going to be anywhere, it's going to be down that area. And there's been a few times where you start to get that prickly, you know, on the back of your neck, and you start looking around a little bit more than you normally would. And, you know, who knows, if there's going to be a place that Bigfoot lives, that's it. Middle of nowhere, you know,
not the Deschutes,
he'd be spotted pretty easy.
There's no cover. Yeah,
man. It's going to be sticking out like a sore thumb. I've seen a few black bears down there.
Oh yeah.
And you're like, holy shit, that's a black bear from like 800 yards away. You can see that thing. So old Sassy might not be a good bet out there.
Man,
plus,
I mean,
it's too hot.
I want all this stuff. I want it all to be real. I mean,
yeah, same.
Most of it. But you know, the Bigfoot videos are, I think they've all been pretty disappointing since the Patterson film. Like the Patterson film, which is still debated. I actually even like made up something in my own mind that the guy had confessed that on his deathbed, that it was phony. But that was something totally different. It was something totally, some other hoax. And this one wasn't ever like it. It's still the best video I've seen. I saw one the other day that was listed as a Bigfoot video that was clearly a dude in a cave, like from like far off, and it was like a guy. Like you can tell it was just like a homeless guy in a cave. And it turned out that the video was, it looked super remote, but it was right near some tourist area and stuff.
Of course.
I mean,
I was a member of the North American Bigfoot Research Organization for a long time.
You were.
Love getting emails. Somebody would have a sighting, and like I'd get an email, like, this is it. This is the, I forget what they used to call it, the like an assessment, like this is what happened. Yeah. And I just loved reading those things.
Dude, but I think I saw somebody with that bumper sticker in my neighborhood the other day that was like, it looked all official. It wasn't like somebody that was making fun of themselves for it or anything like that. Yeah. Like it looked for real.
I had one of my Xterra, and when I crashed it, I was so bummed. I was sitting there with my pocket knife trying to peel that sticker off. I'm like, damn it. That's the most important part of this, 2000 Nissan Xterra. I just want the sticker off the bumper.
So you were into it then. Like, what do you think is your, what do you think is the most, besides Patterson, the Patterson film, is it maybe the Sierra sounds? What's the most compelling evidence, you think? Or story, or
oh man, I'd say that that's the toughest part, right? Yeah. And you know, I've listened to my fair share of podcasts on the road, mm-hmm. and you know, this Bigfoot or paranormal podcast come through occasionally, and you know, you hear a lot of stories of you know, it being this extraterrestrial or something like that. I mean, if it is out there, it's damn good at hiding, not only from, you know, a camera, but game cams and all that stuff. I think, you know, sounds for sure. You know,
you know the Sierra sounds, right? The one we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, the hooting and hollering and the howling and stuff like that. I mean, I've heard that down on the Trinity. You hear that that whooping howl, and you kind of just like, that's not a coyote. I know that's not a bobcat. Definitely not a mountain lion. Like, you start to check off those boxes pretty quick. You know, not something I'm familiar with, but. Other than the Patterson film, I think that's kind of the pinnacle, right? And it's a bummer because we all have, you know, iPhones on us that have these phenomenal cameras, and you know, any second could be ready to take that next good Sasquatch shot.
Somebody just recently did more. I don't know what you call it. Some kind of video work on that, bringing up more definition and all these kinds of things. So, you know, making it more high def and detailed, and just made it look more real. To be honest, I don't know. I have no opinion on that one. I am like so far in the middle on it.
Yeah. It was X-Files. I want to believe, right?
Yeah.
That's where I'm at. I want him out there. I want him to be out there, you know, in Steelhead Country. And, I'll keep my fingers crossed to get to see him one day.
I'm like right in the middle on all that stuff too, though. Like where, like, I don't even know what I want it to be. Like, I don't know if I want it to be a missing link or something like interdimensional or whatever, like extraterrestrial, like you said. Like, I don't know what it seems like such a crazy story because it's permeated through so many cultures for so long that, like, it's, I don't know. And there's so little believable evidence and been so eaten up by hoaxers. Like, it's just like, the evidence is muddied up anyway. So it's such a tough one.
Yeah, like I said, I want to believe. For me, I really enjoy backing stuff with science and no fur, you know, little things like that. You're like, he's out there. He's damn good at hiding.
Yeah, the bones too, right? Like how they don't. Yeah,
I mean, something, right?
There would something be something. And then they come up with excuses like that they bury their dead, right, or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
everybody knows.
You know. I want to believe.
Yeah. Well, cool, man. Yeah. Those are all my questions, Jeremiah.
Awesome.
We covered them all. We talked a lot about the Deschutes, and it just primed me up even more. Like, I want to go up the river better. The idea of being able to catch that kind of fish in like a desert type environment in Oregon.
Yeah.
Sounds super cool and different. The not being able to fish out of the boat. You gotta taxi and get out and wade. That sounds cool to me too, and different. And I just got to finally make the trip. I mentioned I'm going to be up there, next weekend I'm supposed to fish the McKenzie, but won't have time to get over there.
So. Yeah. McKenzie's going to be big. It'll be fun.
Man, I can't wait. Been stoked to fish that one for a bunch of time.
Awesome, man.
If you're ever in Sac, man, let's hook up and have a beer or something, man. I'd love to meet you in person and, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I'll be down in your neck of the woods. I'm actually picking up Eric Leininger from the Sac Airport.
Oh, shit.
Towards the end of this month, we're going to go fish the Costa Bass and Fly tournament.
Oh, down
the
cool. Delta. You guys are a team? You guys are a team on it?
Oh, we're the A-team, baby.
Right on, dude. Man, that's
so
great.
Last year, we got sixth place. I think I got the second biggest bass out of the tournament. So this year, we're going for blood. We're going for the trophy.
Hell yeah, I'll be rooting for you. Yeah. Right on.
Awesome, man. All right, appreciate it.
Thank you, dude.
Yeah, see ya.
How about that? Maybe the most informative interview I've been part of since I started this show. and it only made me want to fish the Deschutes even more than I had before. It gave me an excuse to barely write about fly tying or fishing for my little monologue too, which was fun. It was more creative writing than book report this time around, which was a nice break. The Deschutes is really not that far from me either, so I'll definitely make it up there in the near future, and I'll try to force Jeremiah at a guide retirement to show me around the place. Thanks again, Jeremiah. I hope to hit the water with you someday. So, one monologue idea that didn't make the cut was making up a fake story about how Lake Billy Chinook got its name. I had many ideas, but none of them were very funny. Luckily, the real story is good enough. Come to find out, William J. Chinook III held a county chair on the Bend City Council in the 1960s. He was mostly unassuming, but was known to have a temper. After 8 long years of feeling like his voice was being ignored on the local political stage, his temper boiled over and he went on a killing spree, drowning his victims in what was then a secluded, nameless lake. Anglers like you and me were his main prey, and he would lure them to their deaths with tales of a top-secret honey hole. Eventually, one lucky man managed to escape before his soon-to-be watery demise and made it to the closest police station, where he was able to lead them back to Chinook. When the law finally caught up to Chinook, he was sentenced to death, and the jury decided that they wanted him to choose how he'd go. They were able to agree that the man was guilty and should be sentenced to die, but they couldn't come to terms on how he should be executed. They gave him 3 options: hanging by the neck until he was dead, death by firing squad, or sitting in the electric chair. Chinook had never liked being told what to do, so he decided to write in his own option. It was 5 words: drown me in my lake. The jury nervously laughed as if he was joking, but those 5 words were the only words he said for the rest of the time he spent on this earth. Drown me in my lake. He said it over and over again, anytime he was spoken to. So they did. The lake finally got its name, Lake Billy Chinook. Not in tribute to a grisly murderer, but to the victims that died thinking they were about to hook into the biggest fish of their lives, only to...
What the hell are you doing?
I'm sorry. That's obviously not the real story about how Lake Billy Chinook got its name. It was named for Billy Chinook, a Native American of the Wasco tribe who traveled alongside American explorers John C. Fremont and Kit Carson in their expeditions of 1843 and 1844. Chinook also served as first sergeant of U.S. Army Wasco Scouts during the Snake War. The lake was named in his honor. He didn't drown anyone in the lake. What am I doing?
Yeah, what are you doing?
I even told you one of my stupid ideas after I said I wouldn't. That's what you get for empowering a mentally unstable idiot to host a podcast. I hope you're happy. I'll actually be even more honest right now and admit that I didn't even look up the real story about how the lake got its name until after I wrote down the stupid fake murder story. You may have even caught the moment when this dumb idea was birthed during my interview with Jeremiah. He mentioned Lake Billy Chinook, and I either snickered like a child or commented about it having a great name, I can't remember. But at that moment, I wanted to make up a story about how the lake got its name. I video phoned my buddy, did brainstorm some ideas on it, and the first and only idea we talked about was this murderer story. Now I feel bad, but I'm leaving it in because I need to be held accountable, and I swear to God this is constructive somehow. It helps me. I found these 2 great organizations that help people. They didn't ask me or even agree to be showcased at the end of each episode of season 2, but they haven't asked me to stop yet, so I'm going to drop in their info right here and say see you next time, suckers. Project Healing Waters brings a high-quality, full-spectrum fly fishing program to an ever-expanding number of veterans in need at over 200 locations nationwide. Project Healing Waters programs meet regularly throughout the year with volunteers teaching the basics and advanced techniques while building long-term relationships. It's much more than a one-time fly fishing trip. The program provides basic fly fishing, fly casting, fly tying, and rod building classes for participants whose skills range from beginners who have never fished before to those with prior fly fishing and tying experience. All fly fishing and tying equipment is provided to the participants at no cost. Fishing trips, both one day and multi-day, are also provided free of charge to participants. Visit projecthealingwaters.org to learn more. Fishing the Good Fight is breaking down walls, smashing taboos, and building community. They believe that experiences in nature are an important part of caring for one's mental health. Less than 20% of men struggling with mental illness and/or substance abuse are receiving professional support. The combination of a healthy therapeutic outlet, talk therapy, and a strong community will lead to mental well-being. Men face specific challenges when it comes to addressing mental health issues. According to Mental Health America, 6 million men living in the U.S. suffer from depression. In a National Center for Health Statistics studies, nearly 1 in 10 men reported experiencing some form of depression, but less than half sought treatment. 70% of all people who die by suicide are men. That's from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Men are often reluctant to seek help, particularly for depression, and are far less likely to access professional mental health services than women. Men make up less than 25% of people treated for depression and or substance abuse. For a lot of men, fishing the Good Fight program, such as a retreat, is the first time they have opened up about struggles they faced, and 100% of men who attended a recent retreat indicated that they would seek professional help after the treatment. If you've ever wondered about your own mental health and wanted to improve your quality of life, Fishing the Good Fight can provide the tools, resources, and support to guide you along your wellness journey. FishingTheGoodFight.org has more information.
This episode of The Secret Society of Fly Tires is brought to you by Sage. Ah, Sage. What a delicious aroma. What a delicate spice. There's nothing quite like Sage for seasoning a roast goose or mixing with some browned butter. Sometimes I just have Sage and browned butter as a whole meal. You might think that's weird, but it's not. Sage is a good flavored leaf, and I'm proud of them being a sponsor, okay? This episode of The Secret Society of Fly Tires is brought to you by our good friends at George Michael Jordan's Tackle Shop here in beautiful Alta, California. I know you know that old George is a lizard fanatic, but that don't mean that he don't know a thing or two about a thing or two when it comes to fishy wishies. So get on over to George Michael Jordan's Lizard Farm and visit the newly constructed tackle shop. It's a little shack next to the outhouses. You'll find it. Don't worry. Just come on down and we'll take care of you. Please note that this is not a real advertisement, and the company, brand, entity, or product mentioned in the preceding ad in no way endorses, agrees with, or knows about this podcast.